I remember thinking to myself, wow, next year I get to go to school and I'll actually be able to read these. So I did go to school, I did learn to read, and I absolutely adored it. Growing up in Curve Lake is like growing up in any small town, especially when you're my age. I'm about 1,000 years old. And I actually grew up in a house with no plumbing or electricity. And then in grade 7, our reserve got a housing grant. And we actually moved to a house with, of all things, a wonderful glorified concept called a toilet. Outhouses in January lose their mystique. Anyway, so we got a television. And now all the older people will understand this. If the younger people don't understand this, ask somebody nearby with white or gray hair. We had two channels, and both of them were very snowy. So, and in a small town, right, there's, at that time, there's not a lot to do. You can only go climbing so many trees, only go swimming in the lake so many times during the summer, and in winter, there's even less to do. So that's why I gravitated towards reading. Every book I read took me someplace. It was a passport to exotic people, interesting locations, and amazing adventures. So I would read and read and read and read to the point where my grandparents, whose first language was Anishinaabemowin, scolded my mother saying, why do you let him read so much? It's not normal. So I would read and read. And the more I read, the more I became fascinated by the possibility of becoming a writer. It intrigued me because the great thing about being a writer is, like all artists, you create something hopefully magnificent, original, and that the public wants out of nothing at all, out of your sheer imagination. Not only that, you have more control over the universe you create than the universe you live in. And who doesn't like that? So I would toy with the idea of being a writer, but I didn't know if I could be a writer. Because one of the things, some people here who are aware of their Canadian history, Native people weren't allowed to do a lot of things. There's what was called the potlatch ban, which prevented us from participating in our culture, our language, our belief structure. Basically, being Native was essentially outlawed. And there was also a whole whack of bizarre other little laws. It used to be illegal, and this is for lawyers, I repeat, this was for lawyers. It used to be illegal for lawyers to have Native clients. So there were so many bizarre things. So when I was growing up, there was no Native literature in our course, there were books about Native people, but no books by Native people in our library system. And for people out there who are wondering, who are looking up here and seeing the guy with no noticeable cheekbones and bluish green eyes talking about Indigenous literature, my standard joke is I'm half Ojibwe, half Caucasian, so technically that makes me an occasion. Or as I like to say, a special occasion, if not a memorable occasion. I didn't know if Native people could be writers. So I decided to do what youth have been doing for thousands of years. I decided to seek wisdom from my elders. First person I went to was my grade 11 English teacher. I remember very distinctly walking into the room. He was sitting at his desk looking for something in the bottom left-hand drawer of his desk. And I walked up and I said, sir, is it possible to make a living from creative writing? And without looking up, he said, no, not really. So that was my note of encouragement from my English teacher. No, not really. And as I said, being a fan of irony, decades went by and I achieved some success as a playwright and a novelist. And one of the things I get to do frequently is I get to travel across the country, across the continent and in other countries too, lecturing to people about Indigenous literature, or more specifically, to Native schools, or not Native schools, to schools in general about literature. So I've talked, oh God, I've lost track of how many schools I've talked to young people about being a writer. And when I'm in front of them, I always say, The only thing you need to remember, the one nugget of information you need to take with you when you walk out that door, the only reason I'm here is to let you know, never trust your grade 11 English teacher. And I know that from personal experience. And of course, again, the decades are by. He's still around in Peterborough, and he takes great pride in telling me not to be a writer. The other person I went to was my mother. I told my mother I wanted to be a writer, and my mother looked at me with a very perplexed look, saying, "Why do you want to be a writer? It's not going to get you anywhere." So this is my mother telling me this. "Why do you want to be a writer? It's not going to get you anywhere." And I knew where my mother was coming from. My mother had a grade 6 education at what was called an Indian day school. Her first language was Anishinaabe Mohan, and she'd spent about 30 years cooking and cleaning, primarily for white people. So the idea of being a writer was just literally not in her vocabulary, on her radar, or whatever. So with that kind of encouragement, I gave up wanting to be a writer. Nobody seemed to think it was a good idea. I didn't know what else I could do with my life. I could devote myself to working at the band office on the reserve, embezzling money from the Department of Indian Affairs. It's always a possibility. But around this time, I did what I refer to as the res math. I told you how small my reserve was, and I told you how big my family was. So in my mid and late teens, it became painfully obvious to me that I was related to practically every girl on the reserve. And that wouldn't do. So that's as good a reason as any to go to post-secondary school education. And I've never understood why colleges and universities never use that in their recruitment on reserves. So, with all that in mind, I tried to find out what to study. I wanted to be an artist, but that wasn't going to work. Nobody seemed to think it was possible, or that I had a shot, or that I should go for it. But I loved the arts. I've explained why I wanted to be in the arts. If I couldn't be in the arts as an artist, I wanted to be in the periphery. I wanted to be, a hanger-on, a wannabe, I'm with a band type of person. So I took a course. I was going through, way back then, it was in books. Nowadays, as you know, it's on computer, online. But it was these books that had a list of every university in Canada and every course that they taught. So I was going through this stuff, and I found one called Radio and Television. And I thought, I listen to radio, I watch television, how hard can it be? And it was for journalism, which was like the worst thing I could take, because as a child, I was chronically shy. And journalism is essentially phoning people up that you don't know and asking them questions that are frankly none of your business. And so, but I was committed. I signed up, and I did my 2 years there, and then I entered the working force. Now, as I said again, repeating myself, wanted to be in the arts but couldn't hack it, so I'm in the periphery. So I ended up getting all these contracts. I had contracts, I had jobs, but no profession, no career. So during my early 20s, I ended up working for CBC Radio as a trainee producer. I worked for the Canadian Native Arts Foundation, now called Inspire, in the office. I did the sound on two documentaries shot on Indigenous communities across Canada. So doing stuff like that. And then I ended up working for this film company. Now, what's interesting about this is they were doing this television series that took place in a fictional First Nations community in northwestern Ontario, 3 hours north of Thunder Bay. And as was the practice at the time, all the writers were non-Native, all the producers were non-Native, all the directors were non-Native, and a third of the cast was non-Native. And I heard about this because I had a couple actors working on it, and I sort of occurred to me, hey, why not? Let's Let me give it a shot. And I managed to locate a training on the job fund from the Department of Indian Affairs, knocked on their door and said, yada, yada, yada. You really should have somebody native working on this show in the office. I've got half a salary. You should hire me. And they did. Long story short, I knew nothing of film. And so I got all the know-nothing jobs, production assistant, casting assistant, chaperone. And because I was the only native person in the office, I was the ad hoc technical advisor. Because, as we know, the indigenous people in northwestern Ontario, 3 hours north of Thunder Bay, are identical to the indigenous people down here. So they would give me scripts to read and say, is this technically accurate? And I would read them and I would say, yes, native people eat toast. And so basically all that. So I worked on the show. This was a show that nobody here probably saw. It was called Spirit Bay. It was a 13-part series about kids in northwestern Ontario. It was a lovely series. And but while working on the series, I learned how a half-hour television series is created, because they would give me the script. I'd have to help break it down for production stuff. That so I learned that a half-hour script, which is actually about 22, 23 minutes, what goes into it, all that. So I learned how to write a half-hour drama just by osmosis, for lack of a better term. And about a month or so later, I was writing an article for a magazine on adapting native stories into a television and film format. And I decided in order to do this, I had to talk to all the showrunners and story editors of all the television series in Canada at the time. And I talked with this one woman, we were chatting, and I do not even remember if it was me or her, but one of us suggested I submit some story ideas just for the heck of it. And I did. I came up with two, submitted it just for the heck of it. And they liked one. And they commissioned it. I wrote it. They read it. They bought it. They shot it. And they aired it. Just on a lark. Right? And it was for this show that was probably canceled before some of the people in here, parents, were born. It was a show called The Beachcombers. Oh. So I wrote an episode of The Beachcombers. I was 12, and I was 25, and that was my first ever sale of anything as a writer. And what became sort of curious to me was that I sort of understood what had happened when I'd wanted to be a writer in my teens. I didn't have enough, I think, life experience. I was still green. I didn't know what to write about. I tell a lot of young people, you want to be an interesting writer, lead an interesting life. And at that time, you know, I had a very boring life on the reserve. So I had nothing to write about. I had no seasoning on me. So I think the great gods of writing had said, not yet. So I went off and had 10 extra years of experiences, and then in my mid-20s, I was ready to become a writer. Now, that doesn't work. That's not for everybody. Some people are very good writers in their teens. Others have to wait till their late 20s or early 30s, whatever. Everybody's different. But around this time, something interesting was happening in the First Nations community. What I call the contemporary Indigenous literary renaissance. There was this explosion of Indigenous literature suddenly out of nowhere exploding into the dominant culture. Playwrights, novelists like Thompson Highway, Jeanette Armstrong, Lee Miracle, all these people were writing stuff that before nobody had paid attention to, but now the dominant culture was very interested in our stories and what we had to say and how we wanted to say it. So it was just an interesting, glorious time, starting in the late 80s. Now, around this time, I was writing for television. I was doing about one script a year, and that's not really enough to survive on. I was young, nobody really knew me, and I didn't really have that much of a catalog to show around. So my work there was pretty sporadic. And I had this horrible, hungry, evil, insatiable monster constantly breathing down my neck, wanting to be fed, called a landlord. So I needed to keep this monster fed. So I was looking for things to do. And then this is around the time, as I said, native theater became very, very popular. And Thompson Highway, a world-class playwright, was artistic director of a theater company called Native Earth Performing Arts, which was the premier indigenous theater company in Canada. And he got a grant for a writer-in-residency program. And, I mean, that's self-explanatory. It's an opportunity for somebody to come in and learn how a theater company works, learn how theater business works, and usually it's for writer or directors. And so he had a grant. But at that time, there were two working Native playwrights in Ontario. There's himself, who's the artistic director, and the outgoing writer-in-residence, a man named Daniel David Moses. So he was desperate, because if you don't use the grant, you have to give it back to the government. And that goes against the nature of most artists. And so he was desperate. He did what a lot of desperate people do. He went to the bottom of the barrel, and there I was, passed out. And he asked me if I wanted to be the writer in residence. And I said no. I had no understanding of theater. The number of plays I'd seen could count on my fingers. Contrary to popular belief, on my reserve, there is no theater district. And I thought all theater artists were pretentious, and I still do. So I said no. And Thompson, knowing I had that horrible, hungry, vicious creature breathing down my neck, cheated. He said, okay, look at it this way, Drew. All you have to do is sit through the rehearsal of two plays, maybe write a play at the end of it. It's 20 weeks work, and you get a nice big check at the end of each week. And I said, when do I start? So I'm one of the few people you'll meet that got into theater for the money. So while I was working at Native Earth, it was a very, very educational time. Because if I was going to do this, I wanted to know what was going on. So I started to read all the Native plays that were out there, all the ones that were, I was going to see as many as I could. And I sort of picked up something interesting about the contemporary Indigenous literary renaissance. Most of the stories coming out of the First Nations community were dark, depressing, bleak, sad, and angry. Most of the characters were either oppressed, depressed, or suppressed. And that's for a very specific reason. When an oppressed people get their voice back, they're going to write about being oppressed. Makes perfect sense. Thompson Highway even has a saying, before the healing can take place, the poison must be exposed. So I was in this phase, I was reading all these plays and these novels by Native artists. And as I said, it dealt with the dysfunctional aspect of the First Nation community. There's a term that was coined to describe it. It was called trauma porn, because it just dealt with all the issues happening with Indigenous people, the colonialism, the racism, residential schools, all that sort of stuff. And I was there in the middle of this, and I was like, I was confused. I was still trying to really find my voice. I'd found, you know, television is not really an avenue to find your distinctive voice. Basically, you're given characters, you're given a location, you're given a universe, and you're just going in and plugging holes with what you write in television. You're not really developing a unique voice. And I wanted to find my unique voice, and I wasn't finding it. So in the midst of this, I was confused. I thought I was going, I could see a career at the end of the hall, but I couldn't quite make it to it. And as luck would have it, I was on the Blood Reserve in Alberta. And I met an elder there, and I was telling him this, and he laughed, and he said, he looked at me, and he said, in his opinion, for Native people, and I think for all people, humor is the WD-40 of healing. And I thought about that. Humor is a WD-40 of healing. That's so cool, it's almost t-shirt worthy. And it makes perfect sense. And if you go back to what Thompson's saying was, before the healing can take place, the humor must be exposed. Humor is a WD-40 of healing. It's all about healing. So when I heard that, I sort of decided the proverbial light went on, that light at the end of the tunnel got a lot closer, and I decided I wanted to go out and I wanted to celebrate, I wanted to shine the spotlight on, I wanted to just go out and explore the world of Indigenous humor in my writing. I do it through a number of ways. I don't know if anybody's here familiar with my articles and essays for the Globe and Mail. I do that quite frequently. I take an issue and I deconstruct it through funny eyes, for lack of a better term. I write several different types of plays. I started off my career writing YA, young audience plays, that were very funny. But I wasn't trying to be funny. It was just, I had been very fortunate to have traveled to over 150 First Nation communities across Canada and the United States. And everywhere I went, I've been greeted with a laugh, a smile, and a joke. And it's my personal opinion, that's what has allowed us to survive all those centuries of oppression. And I wasn't reinventing the wheel here, speaking from a culture that never had the wheel. So humor, I thought this could be fun. So I decided to write my first adult play, which was a comedy. And it was called The Bootlegger Blues, part one of a four-part series I was doing called The Blues Quartet. All sheer celebrations of the Aboriginal sense of humor with absolutely no social redeeming qualities whatsoever. And I later found out that was technically inaccurate. I didn't know as much about Native humor as I thought I did, and I have since refined that view. So my first play was called The Bootlegger Blues. And it's about a 58-year-old good Christian Ojibwe woman who, through a series of circumstances, finds herself in possession of 143 cases of beer that she has to bootleg in order to buy an organ for the church. And it's loosely based on a true story. My mother was so angry when I wrote that play. So, that in itself is interesting. It was produced by a Native theater company on Manitoulin Island called the Bajamajig Theater Group. It toured to Native communities and places like that. And it was fine. It was great. People enjoyed it, but it wasn't considered legitimate theater because it was funny. And Canadian theater in the 80s and 90s, like not just Native theater, I'm talking downtown Toronto theater, was serious and did not do comedies, right? Because Canadian theater is trying to be taken seriously. So it was taken, went to Native communities who loved it. They loved seeing their laughter. And so a couple months after it premiered, I get a phone call from a theater company saying, "We read your play and we'd like to produce it." And I said, "Cool, great, wonderful. Let's do her." So, and I'm thinking all this time, you know, "Oh, ooh, great, I can get some of that Caucasian money I've heard about." So we do what normally happens in theaters. You do rehearsals, you get your cast, you get your director, you go into rehearsals, and you open it. So this was opening at a summer theater, a theater that seated 311 people. It was a very, very good production. Opening night, I'm sitting in the front seat for the Bootlegger Blues, and I'm waiting for those bushels of Caucasian money to come flowing in. Lights come up on my comedy, 311 seats, almost all white people, absolute silence, nothing, quiet. Off in the distance, you could hear coyotes howling. Tumbleweeds went across the stage. And I'm going, "Oh my God." And I'm thinking, first of all, there goes all that money. Second, I may have to learn how to say, "Would you like fries with that?" But I'm thinking, okay, so like, what's going on here? Why aren't they laughing? Because one of the things I have learned about humor, about any substantial emotional response to anything, is, as I said earlier, as a native humorist, we're not reinventing the wheel. What makes us laugh will make you laugh. What makes us cry will make you cry. There are more similarities than differences. And while there may be sort of, it's like seasoning food, you know, some things may be slightly different. The joke has a different focus or whatever. But essentially, our sense of humor is somewhat similar to yours. So the fact that nobody was laughing, I'm like, logically, this does not make sense. So I'm thinking that, trying to figure this out, you know, because like, it was a very successful comedy. The acting was great. The direction was great. Let's face it, the writing was brilliant. And I even made sure they put on the poster, comedy. So I'm looking around, I'm looking up at the balcony. Now, I didn't say this. The theater company is called Lighthouse Theater in Port Dover. It's a summer theater, about 20 minutes away from the largest Indigenous community in Canada, a place called Six Nations. Two of the cast members were from Six Nations. So every performance had 4 to 8 people from Six Nations in it. Brothers, sisters, parents, cousins, aunts, uncles, whatever, coming to see so-and-so. So on that opening night, on the bell, like, it was 311 seats, 300 non-Native people, 6 to 8 Native people, all clumped together on the balcony. They were the only ones laughing. From the very beginning, they were laughing, laughing, laughing. And the most interesting thing happened. After about 5 or 10 minutes, the circle of white people around them started to laugh. Another 5, 10 minutes, another circle. And it kept getting bigger and bigger, like throwing a rock in a pond and watching the rings get bigger and bigger. And what it was, right, at this time, as I said, Canadian theater was very serious. Native theater was very serious. And this audience had shown up to a play about Native people and beer, expecting to be made to feel uncomfortable, because theater at that time pushed the envelope, make the white audience uncomfortable, ask difficult questions. They were not expecting a silly comedy. And as they watched the Native people laugh, essentially they were waiting for permission to laugh, right? Because this was a long time ago. This was before some of the stuff you might see on television now, or even before Dead Dog Cafe. This was their first exposure to Indigenous humor. So by the end of the first act, everybody was laughing. And the play was a big success. I ended up having 4 other plays there at various times. So it sort of showed to me that that not only were we having, looking at our history with a bit of pain, as I said, it's all very dark, the trauma porn. But now the dominant culture was sort of getting that same impression of us, and I sort of like wanted to turn that around and do my bit to spread the gospel of Native literature, Native humor, right? What am I doing for time here? I'm trying to give you my hour and a half lecture in like 45 minutes. My second comedy was called The Baby Blues. And it takes place at a powwow, and it's about an aging powwow dancer, a fancy dancer, who is getting kind of too old to win anymore. He's getting long in the tooth, and he's not winning as much. All the young bucks are beating him, but he refuses to acknowledge the passing years. And he goes to this one reserve that he hasn't been to in a very long time. He's setting up his tent for the powwow, and he sees a beautiful young girl down by the river, and he goes down and starts to sweet talk her. Because basically he believes in dancing, partying, and chasing women. And not necessarily in that order. So he sees this beautiful young girl, he starts to sweet talk her, and through the conversation, both we and he discover it's his long-lost daughter from 18 years ago. Don't you hate it when that happens? And he immediately tries to get away, and he runs into the woman's mother, who sabotages his truck and won't let him leave until he can come up with, in that weekend, 17 years back, child support. Again, don't you hate it when that happens? So anyways, that's basic. And the funny thing is, as I said earlier, I refer to my comedies as having no social redeeming qualities whatsoever. That's an example of me being wrong. We did that play in the States, and it was so interesting how a good chunk of the audience, in this particular in one place, it was like the black audience, where there was, rightfully or wrongly, I'm no expert, a lot of men didn't stay around to take care of what they'd left behind. And they related to that, and they were cheering on. And I suddenly realized, oh yeah, I am making a political statement. And then I began to sort of, I've written a book on Native humor called Me Funny. I'm working on another one now. And basically how humor is context. Humor is understanding. And I'm beginning to, I'm still working that out because it's so complex. Anyway, so, this play gets produced in a couple places, and then I get one of those famous phone calls back in the days before people sent emails. And somebody said, we read your play, and we'd like to produce it. And I said, cool, great, wonderful, send me the check. And I said, no, you're going to have to help us translate it. And I said, what do you mean, translate? He said, oh, I'm sorry, we're phoning from the University of Venice, Italy. And I said, that place with water for streets? And they said, yes. And I say to them, you know, why does the University of Venice want to produce my powwow play? Because I'm thinking it's about an aging powwow dancer, Lothario, chasing women, all that sort of stuff, refuses to acknowledge the passing years, just here for a good time, not a long time. And he said, I think it's something Italians can relate to. So, whatever. We translated it to Italian and they produced it. And unfortunately, I didn't get to Venice for a couple months later, but they sent me this ancient artifact some of you may remember from your ancient history class called a videotape of the production. And I watched it, and it was one of the most surreal things I've ever seen. So just a broad shot of the set. So this is my powwow play in an Italian, I hope I'm saying this, I don't know if there are any Italians in the audience, in a teatro. A theater. So you've got this powwow set designed by an Italian set designer who'd never been to Canada, let alone a powwow. You've got powwow outfits designed by Italian set designers who'd never been to a First Nations community or a powwow. And you've got Italian actors who'd never been to Canada, a First Nations community, or a powwow, running back and forth across the stage going, il powwow. So anyways, I'm sort of getting off here. Long story short, again, I keep saying that. What was really interesting, though, after by the late 90s, early 2000s, the contemporary indigenous literary renaissance was beginning to change. They were beginning to explore other ways of telling our stories. The concept of the trauma porn was becoming, we sort of exposed a lot of the poison, exposed a lot of the trauma. Now we were looking for other ways to tell our stories, right? So a lot of writers began to embrace and explore genre fiction. My very first novel was a Native vampire novel. And I know what you're saying, oh God, not another Native vampire novel. My second novel was a genre of fiction I didn't even know exist until I read about it in the reviews. Magic realism. It was called Motorcycles and Sweetgrass, and it was about the trickster coming back into a First Nations community today. My third book was a collection of indigenous-themed science fiction short stories called Take Us to Your Chief. The next book was what I refer to as a literary novel, and my last book that came out last year was a horror novel. So, and that's just me, right? Daniel Heath Justice wrote a trilogy of books that's basically an indigenous take on Lord of the Rings. It's a trilogy with elves and dwarves in it with sword and sorcery, etc. And it's filtered through his indigenous background with indigenous type themes and characters in it. A friend of mine, Kateri Akowinzi-Dam, edited and compiled a collection of international indigenous erotica that I like to call 50 Shades of Red. And Tom King, when he's not writing award-winning fiction or nonfiction, he writes murder mysteries because he just loves the genre. And it, right now, in this particular window of the indigenous literary revolution, sci-fi is very big in our community. Wabagishik Rice has his Moon of the Crested Snow. You've got Sherry Demerlane and the Marrow Thieves, etc. And that's just like two things right off the top of my head. So these are interesting times as writers, you know, out of nowhere from the mid-80s to suddenly you just don't know what's going to happen. They're, you know, look at sitcoms on CBC and in America, and they're indigenous sitcoms. Who would have ever thought of that back in the 80s or the 90s? These are exciting times, and I'm going to stop there before I keep going on. Some people out there might have questions. Oh, yes. Have I heard of the Ojibwe? I've been to Temagami. I haven't been to Kiwa.
I worked there one summer.
Cool.
At a resort near Bear Island.
Okay, yeah, that's...
There was one telephone. My brother went there to call his girlfriend. He was like 17.
Yeah, I remember going to Temagami a long time ago. Through Trent, actually. They had a resort. Not a resort. They had a retreat up there.
Yeah.
Somebody back there? Yes. Oh, flatterer.
I remember talking about your look. There was something hilarious that you wrote.
About how I look?
No.
And you were describing how people didn't believe you were Native because you didn't look Indian. And didn't you try to find your wallet or go to the trunk of your car or something so you could reduce a...
Oh, okay, yes.
And show it to...
That happened. That was, we were shooting a documentary way up north, north of Timmins, and there was this woman, these two sisters who had a trap line, and one of them had an 11-year-old daughter, and we'd come in, and this little 11-year-old daughter just took a shine to me, would follow me all around, and that thing that sometimes kids do, they try to endear themselves by being as annoying as hell. She'd hide my shoes, all that sort of stuff, because she didn't want me to go, all that stuff. And then, but she would not, and these were two non-status women who had a trap line and the daughter, and this little girl absolutely refused to believe I was Native. Because, you know, up there, everybody really looks Native. And she would not believe I was Native. And then we're getting packing up with equipment or something, and she says, would you like some tea? And I was in the midst of packing up, said, no, thank you, not right now. And she suddenly yells in victory, see, you're not Indian. All Indians drink tea. So that's when I pulled out my status card and thrust my status card at this little 11-year-old non-status girl who had no idea what one was. But yes, so I put that into an essay I wrote. Actually, it was one of the most influential essays I ever wrote. That's sort of one of the things that put me on the map. It was an essay on what it was like being what's called a white passing Native person. It was called Pretty Like a White Boy, The Adventures of a Blue-Eyed Ojibwe. And it's still taught in a lot of universities, a lot of colleges, because it deals with identity, it deals with culture, trying to find yourself type of thing. And it was so successful. I ended up doing a series of other essays exploring Native culture, humor. Again, just whatever would deck my fancy, whatever I put in the globe. And I put them together into one book of essays called Funny, You Don't Look Like One. Adventures of a Blue-Eyed Ojibwe. And it was incredible. It sold out. It was incredibly successful. It was done by a Native publishing house, Thetis Press. And I caused them some problems because small presses like that, they're not designed to make a profit. And my book sold out in 6 months, and they kept having to reprint it. So, and that sort of set the stage for a lot of my career, because a lot of my stuff explores that outsider perspective. I did a trilogy of plays about adoption, again, from that outsider perspective. So, yeah, one of the things I tell a lot of people is take something negative and turn it into a positive, because frequently it'll be a perspective that nobody else has, and you can milk it for all it's worth. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. last year, I'll be using you for came out in the Coffee State movie. It's not native. And, you know, I grew up with Chicago and these other things. So whenever you saw somebody who made it as a native who was there, she was getting awards, it was wonderful. You were being supportive of native culture. And then with Buffy, and I have albums of Buffy. How does that work for you?
That was cataclysmic. In fact, you know that CBC show, not Communion, it's on at 11 o'clock. It talks about pop culture. Yeah, anyways, they were talking about it, the one-year anniversary of Buffy, and they started off by saying, according to playwright Drew Hayden Taylor, it was an action of seismic proportions for the First Nations community. I wrote for the Globe about this, and yes, it was bizarrely huge. I actually knew about it about 6 months before it happened. I have a friend who's an Indigenous reporter in L.A. and covering the Indigenous art scene in L.A. and she phoned me up and asked me, "Have you heard this rumor?" The Canadian equivalent of 60 Minutes is doing a thing on a popular Fifth Estate, by the way. Is doing a piece on a very popular Canadian artist who's actually American, who has made their living from being native but actually isn't. And I was walking along and I thought it was Tom King, because that's actually sort of roughly true. And I said, yeah, I've heard that. And I like Tom's my friend. And I don't know who Tom King is. She said, "It's Buffy St. Marie." And I was in a park walking through Toronto, and I literally stopped, and I'm still digging grass out of my chin. I'm like, "Seriously?" I said, "Yes." And she tried to tell me a little bit. Anyways, it was about 4 months later that it was actually airing, and we're watching it. And, oh, you could just feel the ripples across Canada. It was so weird. And the thing is, I did a documentary on Pretendianism for the CBC called The Pretendians. And I have written a play about it that's going to open in Winnipeg in about 5 months. And it's the interesting thing, like her, Joseph Boyden, Michelle Latimer, all these people, that's just the arts, and there are people in medical and business. These are amazingly talented people that would have been successful regardless of what culture they picked. Like Buffy is a brilliant, brilliant musician, and she didn't have to claim to be native to be brilliant. Same with Joseph Boyden, and it just boggles the mind why this happened. And now she's. She was doing this before, but she's basically retreated back to her ranch in the Hawaii raising goats.
But it's almost heartbreaking.
It's what?
It's almost heartbreaking. Yeah.
Well, she affected, she influenced three generations of people, from her work on Sesame Street to the music to almost anything. And yeah, it is tragic. The repercussions, the dust still hasn't settled.
Are you familiar with the Osage in Oklahoma?
I know of them. I've been to Oklahoma twice.
Back in the Reign of Terror, when they were killing, whites were killing all of
them. Oh, yeah.
I'm reading it. It's history. It's by Grant.
Right. It was done as a movie by Scorsese, yeah.
Yeah, The Flowers of the Killer
Yeah.
That's why I'm trying to finish now. Just ripping.
Yeah.
Bedtime reading.
It's never been that's about the other thing. It's not never been easy being indigenous, and yet you have these people who wake up one morning and said, "I think I'll be indigenous now."
Yeah.
Somebody, yes?
Yeah. Can you talk a bit about your writing process?
My writing process. It depends on what I'm writing. How to start this? When I'm writing a novel, I'm trying to figure out how to best explain this, because each one has a different style or whatever. If I'm writing a play, I'm trying to figure out what are my characters, how can I say what I want to say with a limited amount of characters. You know, in a novel you can throw as many people in as you want. With a play, you can only have, in today's financial environment, 2 to maybe 5 or 6. I think what I want to think, and same with the novels too, I plan it out in my head. There are people who like to do notes, who like to write out an outline. I don't do that because I'll share a secret with you. I actually don't like writing. I hate writing. If I could do anything else, I would, but I have no serviceable talents, so I became a writer. So writing an outline is just more writing. I think about it. I keep it all in my head. Like A leads to B. I think about it when I'm driving, when I'm in the shower, all of that. It all, big chunks, you know, they fit together. What I do take notes of are small little things. A joke, an idea, just a quick idea, a funny line, something, a painting in a room that you think, oh yeah, that would be good because it'll reflect this. So I have books of tiny little notes about tiny little things. But when I'm writing the big things, I say I'd have to have about 60% to 70% of it in my head over a year. And then I will sit down and I will start writing it from page one all the way through. Now, that doesn't mean, like when I'm writing it, when I'm writing draft one, that's all I work on. But I may be working on a novel, a nonfiction, a play, thinking about them at different times and piecing bits together. Because, you know, if I work on just a novel, it'll be like 3 years between projects. But right now, as I said, I have two new plays opening this coming season. I'm almost finished a nonfiction book about Native literature. I've got another novel coming out with Don Douglas and McMillan Stewart, and I have optioned to a film company, and we're just in the discussions for doing a 6-part series, and I'm talking with another film company about doing a 6-part documentary series on Indigenous humor. So like I'm juggling all of them, right? But putting them all in, so my brain is kind of clogged. Yes.
You said this started with comic books.
Yes.
Do you think you'll ever write Indigenous comic books and stake a claim on a new genre?
I love the idea. I have one graphic novel, that my Native vampire novel, that was very successful, and we got requests to do it as a graphic novel, so we turned it into a graphic novel. And one of the things I discovered is graphic novels are very unique, specific genre, and I tried my hand at it. And you're talking to a guy who works in about 5 or 6 different genres. I couldn't wrap my mind around it. I think I'm going to leave that to those who do that better. So I don't mind consulting, writing the story, but actually, how, you know, what image goes where and how, that's not me. Yes.
What would you work with MPN? How do you feel about that? Like I got that.
Yeah,
that was so well done.
You're talking. Hi, Gail. You're talking about going Native,
yes.
Right? It's a. I have a three-part. Three-part. It's a 3-year television series, a documentary series with APTN called Going Native, where we travel across the country, the states. And in our final season, we went to the Yucatan Peninsula with the Maya, went to Australia and New Zealand with the indigenous people there. And basically the focus of the series is to show the wild, the wacky, the wonderful, the amazing, the peculiar things of indigenous people across this country and around the world. And we did 3 seasons of it. It was fun. It was amazing. And I was so hoping we'd go to a 4th season because we were planning to go to the South Pacific and island hop. That would have been lovely. We had a really great time. APTN was encouraging us. APTN saw, we did 3 documentaries for APTN. One on showing the German fascination with native people called Searching for Winnetou. One about the wild rice drama happening in the Kawartha Lakes. And the third one on the Pretendians. And the board of directors at APTN said, why aren't we doing this stuff? So they threw us a bunch of money and we did that stuff for them. And unfortunately, we have not been renewed. So I'm available.
Yes. You mentioned the German fascination with First Nation culture. I wasn't aware of that, actually. Yeah, I don't know.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, maybe I was under a rock. I don't know. But what do you think it is about First Nation culture that
Well, it goes back to the writings of a man named Carl May in the 1880s, who wrote a series of westerns based on a very noble Apache warrior named Winnetou and his sidekick, Old Shatterhand. And basically, it romanticizes the indigenous experience and the wilderness and the adventure and basically the nobility of these people. Carl May wrote it in the 1880s, and it became bizarrely successful for like the 5 generations of Germans. There are movies, there's other book series that were done. Only 3 novels were done, but more were written by other people. Movies. There are clubs in Germany where you can go and dress up and pretend to be Cree. Things like they have powwows. In the documentary, we went, there's a place called Pullman City, which is a Western city. And they have a daily powwow. They bring over 3 North American indigenous people. One was from Michigan, one was from Manitoulin Island, and one was from the Navajo Reservation. And there's 50 other German powwow dancers with their own regalia that they have handmade. And it's hard to describe. But this, I'll give you an example. Carl May was the best, next to the Bible, Carl May's book sold more than any other book in the history of Germany. Albert Einstein, Albert Schweitzer, and Joseph Goebbels were his biggest fans. And in the 1930s, this guy named Adolf Hitler, you may have heard of him, released an edict in the 1930s proclaiming that North American Aboriginal people were honorary Aryans.
Oh, wow.
So we have that going for us. Anybody else? And I've had 20 lecture tours of Germany. I may be going this fall. The Cold has been translated into German. They want me to go over there. I have a theater company that translated one of my plays into German and had it there and are going to take it on tour again. And there's a theater company in St. John's, New Brunswick that's taking one of my plays over. So it's like, das ist gut, sehr gut.
How did you feel when White Story
broke? I was on the beach in Mazatlan. At that time I didn't, but then I got a call from the Globe and Mail saying, this has just happened. Can you have 800 words for us as a response by tomorrow at 10? And I'm on the friggin' beach. And I said, we're giving you an opportunity, there's money, whatever. And I said, told my lovely partner, Janine, I have to head back to the room. So I wrote an article about that, and then he had a response, I think, in Maclean's, and I wrote an article about that. I knew Joseph. I did book tours with him. He's a sweetheart of a guy, really nice, just incredibly naive, and I guess not, I don't know what to say. I don't want to say dim because he's actually quite smart, but it's just, I do not know why he did that.
And Kinsella's Dance Beyond Sight, is that
new? No, it's not. It's Ukrainian Canadian humor.
I loved it.
So did I. In the '80s, until I grew up and learned better. How are we doing for time? I'm sorry. All right, take one more question. One more question from anybody? Yes.
Do you hunt fish?
Do I hunt fish? Are they in season?
My grandson is 25, 26, and he hunts some fishes. He is.
Ah. No, I hire other people to. I hire white people to do that for me.
Thank you so much. That was amazing. Thank you. This is just a little swag for you to remember us by.
For anybody who doesn't know, swag stands for stuff we Aboriginals get.
Thank you. We love having you here. I hope you come back. I believe you're okay to sign a couple of books.
If anybody here has some disposable income, I have some books back there.
Yeah, and I got to try and get you some change. But, you know, just thank you so much. That was wonderful. One more big round of applause.
Matter what you do. Mm-hmm.